Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
When we look to Singapore, they are a highly urbanized nation, and they rely heavily on agricultural food imports.
Undersecretary for Trade, Alexis Taylor.
They are a key logistics hub to the Asia-Pacific region, and they host a lot of buyers from the whole region in Singapore. And so Singapore is a market that we are interested in, but getting into the Singapore market, you really are able to tap into that entire region. Our exports are growing there as well. We saw 190% growth from 2012 to 2022, reaching a record in 2022 of $1.4 billion. Just a really exciting market. I think they are a sophisticated market, and a lot of like U.S. consumer packaged goods, those products that are going directly to consumers as a high income country, it's a great opportunity.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I noticed that in my committee work with working with folks from the other side, they don't understand, or they have up to this point, at least they feign not to understand, that wildlife is managed again by state agencies.
Harriet Hageman is a new member of the House of Representatives from Wyoming.
I'll use Wyoming, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. So even for endangered or threatened species, we don't have a bunch of federal employees running around Wyoming and protecting our grizzly bears or our wolves or any other. Well, wolves aren't listed anymore, but the grizzly bears are. It is the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. And as an example of what I mean by that, Wyoming has spent $59 million recovering the grizzly bear population. The federal government has spent $100,000, yet it's the federal government and the Fish and Wildlife Service that refuses to delist the grizzly bear, despite the fact that we met our recovery goals almost a quarter century ago. So here we are 25 years later, we have double the population of grizzly bears that was included in that recovery plan, and we can't delist because the environmental groups, again, use the Endangered Species Act to control activities on private land. So yeah, I think it's very clear that people back here in Washington, D.C. do not understand how we manage water, how we manage wildlife, how we manage a lot of these resources, yet they're the ones that are making the decisions. And it is, it's been very challenging to our producers, to our oil and gas developers, to our coal miners, to our Department of Transportation, to so many organizations, private and public, because Washington, D.C. is where the rules are made, but they're enforced out at an area where the folks back here, they don't understand Wyoming.
She's also co-sponsor of the Prime Act.
The Prime Act is a bill. Thomas Massey is the primary sponsor of that. I'm a co-sponsor. And essentially what it does is it rewrites the statutes and gets rid of a lot of the regulations that the federal government started imposing in the 1960s that make it extremely difficult, especially for a state like Wyoming, where we don't have big packers or big packing plants, for us to be able to adequately process the meat and on behalf of our farmers and ranchers, local communities, restaurants, and everything else. The way the situation is right now is that unless the facility is USDA inspected, if it is state inspected, it has to meet the exact same extremely stringent requirements that a federal facility has to meet, but we can only sell intrastate. So it makes absolutely no sense. We have really put up barriers to our ability for our local producers to reach out to restaurants, for example, and provide their local beef for that, or for our ranchers to custom feed and custom butcher for people. The laws make no sense. They're very draconian, and we're trying to fix that. We had four incredible witnesses. I would encourage people to go and watch the committee hearing today. It lasted just a couple of hours. I realize that's a lot of time, but I think that we presented some extremely important information for our cattle and hog and chicken producers. And we also started addressing the fact very openly about the fact that we have a monopolistic situation with the four big packers in this country, and that needs to change. We've got a situation with agency capture where those four packers basically control the USDA and the FDA when it comes to things associated with our meat production, and we need to change that. They're the ones that are raking in massive amounts of cash. They're trying to vertically integrate the cattle industry. They've largely done that with pigs and chickens, but they're also trying to vertically integrate our cattle industry, and I think it would be really devastating. We need to move away from the monopolistic model, and we need to expand our availability for packing, for butchering, and have more custom-type operations.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Profit margins have shifted from the benefit to the benefit of the processor and retailer from the farmer and rancher in the last 8 years.
1 year ago, Jesse Huff with Nebraska Beef and Lamb explained why they wanted to pursue vertically integrated models.
Our conclusion is we need to shift our participation in the processing and retail to be sustainable on a long-term basis. Secondly, many small butchers have gone out of business in the last 20 years. Currently, there's limited space to harvest animals on a local basis for producers who want to custom harvest and market their products from the farm-to-table concept. Also, the large processors, the big four we call them, cannot accommodate what I would call niche markets. That may be a religious-based harvest requirements or specialty meats such as Wagyu or Kobe. Third, the sheep and goat farming in the upper Midwest has been declining. We are considering the development of locally raised sheep and goat operations to provide inventory to harvest in our plant for ethnic market needs. We want to assist young local farmers with an opportunity to diversify their operations with locally raised sheep and goat by providing seed stock to start their operations. Recently, Costco has developed relationships with young farmers in the area, and we kind of want to mimic their model. The state of Nebraska and the USDA already have great programs to help young farmers and develop this diversification in their operations. Fourth, the business risks are just not involving the cattle market. Supply chain issues are showing up in input costs for our farming, input feed costs for our livestock, and also in increased costs of construction for our project. From our initial budget a year ago, we've seen a 20% increase in cost for our project. This is added risk. We continue to evaluate those risks and hope we can still accomplish our goals.
So how does he describe the business plan?
Some of the existing businesses that we're involved in, our multiple family operation of 20 team members consists of a 350-head cow-calf operation, a 5,000-head cattle feeding capacity. We also raise 1 million bushels of corn, 250,000 bushels of soybeans, and 10,000 tons of forage. These products are primarily used to feed our livestock, and the manure from the livestock fertilizes our fields. In the fall and the spring, we also grow 9,000 acres of cover crops. This is for carbon sequestration, soil health, water quality, and animal grazing.
But why make the investment into the farm-to-table concept?
We believe today's consumers want to be closely connected to the people who produce their food, the farm-to-table concept. One of our team members is an immigrant to the U.S. from Iraq. As a refugee in a UN 27,000-person camp, he took a leadership role in the distribution for that camp. Many of the refugees from that camp now live in the United States in large Midwest cities. These ethnic groups are requesting halal products in sheep, goat, and beef. We can accommodate these religious harvests and follow the quality and humane USDA standards of animal harvesting. We also want to continue to serve our local market within 200 miles of the facility. This accommodates consumers who want to fill their freezers with locally raised meat and provide custom harvests for neighboring animal producers who have existing brands or retail markets.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I'm going to start with a quote, actually, from a colleague, Alan Gray from Purdue University as well.
Stephen Peterson is district manager for Syngenta in Wisconsin.
Productivity is the name of the game for most of us. Continuous improvement is about doing 10 things 1% better, not one thing 10% better. Now, as we look at how we do production, everybody wants to produce more. Everybody wants to produce for less cost. But we have this dynamic of you have fixed costs and you have your variable costs. How do we maximize what we have for our revenue to make sure that we are producing the highest revenue and return on investment as we go forward? Dr. Allen progresses and he goes on to state, we can't make good input decisions if we don't know cost per bushel. Spending additional money always appears to raise costs when we look at it on a per acre basis. But if we ignore yield inputs, higher yielding inputs may be overlooked because we're only focused on the cost side of the business. Again, looking at the variable costs versus the fixed costs, and I think we're going to have a good discussion here later today about what that actually entails and what that means. So again, to reference, fixed costs would include your machinery, land, insurance, interest, and so on. And your variable costs would include things such as your seed, fertilizer, and chemicals, which includes about 40%, and the other one's about 60%. Dr. Gray goes on and he states this. He says, those fixed costs benefit from improvement in productivity. The more bushels we can produce, the more we can take those fixed costs and spread them over those bushels, reducing the fixed cost per bushel. As we look over the last numerous years, you can see that the productivity gap is definitely smaller now than it was in the past. You look at from 1996 all the way through about 2006 or so, you had an opportunity to make money if you didn't even do some of the right decisions along the process. But as we've gotten into the last decade or so, those opportunities for profit have diminished and gotten smaller and smaller. Therefore, the small choices that we make have a big impact on how we are profitable on our farm, or maybe we're not profitable on our farm. The same goes for soybeans and looking at the break-even gap. The difference between making money and not making money can be just a couple key decisions. Ultimately, it starts with smart planning, season-long opportunities, strategic, long-term thinking, specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. Some people call those SMART objectives. And the next thing is custom agronomic solutions, utilizing our trusted agronomic advisor network, whether it be a retailer or our crop consultants that are knowing our local area for our local crops and our local problems. And finally, a broad portfolio of products with a wide range, whether it be low-cost inputs, maybe some higher-cost inputs, but looking at that long range. And the other range, looking at early season all the way through till the end of the season. There's inputs that we have to be able to maximize and utilize throughout the whole season. This leads us into the next key thing that we'll talk about, and it goes into robust roots, ultimately hold more water, cleaner and greener leaves, capture more light, and ultimately healthier stocks provide a better harvest for what we have to be able to put into the bin. So growers must use all the resources and all the industry experts to maximize the plant's production and yield. And this ultimately starts with understanding the cycle of the plant development, whether it's from start, middle, to the end.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Glad to be the the chairman of the Subcommittee on Forestry and Agriculture. And
Doug LaMalfa from California is a member of the House Ag Committee.
That has direct oversight of U.S. Forest Service, which is a big part of the problem of them not moving at what we call the pace and scale they should be on managing those lands. And so many of the fires that start in those lands become giant conflagrations, you know, which the Dixie Fire of 2 years ago burned 1 million acres in my district from... It kind of picked up where the campfire, which burned Paradise, it started just a few miles from the origin of the campfire. It burned north, and the campfire one burned more or less west and devoured about 90% of the town of Paradise. The Dixie Fire burned about 75% of the town of Greenville and all of the town of Canyon Dam nearby. And there's so many of these stories. You know, we had the Beckworth Fire farther over on the east that, you know, ate a lot of houses over there and property. And, of course, all these are burning up the people's assets, their national forests. And the downside, not only that of them being gone, is the loss of habitat, the wildlife, the effect it has on our watersheds with all the ash, and then later erosion. You know, when you lose all this, you get erosion on these hills, and so it turns into mud and gets in the streams and gets eventually into the water supply in some of our lakes. In some cases, it could even block the ability for the hydroelectric plants to operate as it blocks off the penstock. So positive forest management has so many good things to it. The only thing it doesn't please is the environmental groups that don't seem to want any of it to happen.
He also is looking forward to the writing of the next farm bill.
Well, as a member of the Ag Committee, we've been active getting around the country, having a lot of listening sessions. Our chairman, G.T. Thompson's been doing an excellent job of coordinating, pulling that together. I've been on several of the stops, not every single one, but Pennsylvania and Connecticut and Texas and Oregon, Central California. Some of these are also hearings on forestry as well, so I'm kind of blending them. But it's all important to the product that we need to get out this year. We don't want to have a failure in getting the farm bill. So Chairman Thompson and all of us are very focused on being successful getting something out of the House, maybe by the end of July, and that'll give enough time before the turns into a pumpkin in September, at the end of September. And because we don't want that to lapse. If it lapses, then we have to either do a stopgap temporary measure, or if it reverts back to the law, the bill not being renewed, then it goes back to 30s Dust Bowl era type backup legislation, which won't be very good for anybody the way that works. So we're optimistic that we're going to get there. There doesn't seem to be any pushback from any groups on going forward. We have to get Democrats and Republicans to agree on it. The Dems are always really focused on the social side of it, meaning the SNAP program, which is about 82% of the funding of the Farm Bill. And, it needs to be renewed as well, and we need to do a good job of that. But like any program, it's also proper for us to look at are things needed to make it work better, and the people that are truly eligible are the ones that benefit best. Then, other parts would include the conservation piece and actually the production ag part, which is what keeps farmers farming. And, crop insurance is very important. Disaster relief is offset if you have more and more crop insurance. More specialty crops want to be included in that. You want to have a good safety net for that. Our walnut growers from California, for example, had a really bad year last year. So we want to have them be able to be in the safety net so they don't have to come hat in hand for help on recovering from that. So we're helping them right now, but going forward, you just want to have a strong net for everybody.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Number one, it is hard to overstate the importance of free trade to American agriculture.
South Dakota Representative Dusty Johnson says there's four key building blocks to growing trade.
Jane mentioned that it's a 20% of overall ag output, and that's true. But for many geographies and for many products, it's bigger than that. For instance, South Dakota soybeans, 60%. Of our soybeans go overseas. Just a hugely important part of the South Dakota farm economy. And I think that we have real opportunity to grow that. I mean, if you had to ask me whether or not that 20%, that one out of five, is going to go up or down over the course of the next 5 or 10 years, I would be very, very bullish on the fact that it is headed up. Because we know that the world is hungry for our ag materials. And I think there's just tremendously good news ahead. So that's number one. Well, number two, to realize that potential growth, we have got to get a vision. We need a game plan. And, notwithstanding the nice announcement about the UK-US trade agreement here a day or two ago, I mean, I would view that as relatively modest. Now, listen, I get it. If you make American whiskey or if you're in American tobacco, this is a relatively big deal for you. But there is a lot more out there that we can get done. And I'm a little concerned that it's March, not March of last year, but March of 2022. We still don't have a chief ag negotiator. We don't have a USDA undersecretary for trade and foreign agriculture. We do not have these basic building blocks in place. And so to the extent that any of you are ever talking to anybody with the administration, remind them that the clock is ticking. You know, perhaps one third of the time that Joe Biden is going to have to be president has already expired. And if we're going to realize these gains that we talked about in point number one, we got to have our team on the field. So number three, where we're at right now is not good. We have seen a relatively substantial loss of markets because of the supply chain crunch. And I suspect many of the viewers today, Jane, are feeling that acutely. I think the numbers are that 21% of American ag sales last year were lost. Or what they could have been, were lost because of the supply chain crunch. This is a serious problem. We know because of history that you can lose these markets. You can lose these customers overnight, but it takes years to build them back up. And so ag processors, ag manufacturers, ag producers, they are looking to us to get it right because they know the system right now is going to cost them money. You just look at one industry, American dairy, you look over only 6 months, the supply chain crunches cost them $1.3 billion. And I feel it in my backyard, Valley Queen. They're a dairy processor out of Milbank, South Dakota. You know, they had 2 million pounds of lactose that they could not get onto a container. And we can blame the supply chain crunch, but the reality is that 60% of containers that went back to Asia last year went back empty. At some point, we've got to hold these foreign flagged ocean carriers accountable. They have the space. They won't let us put our stuff in it. And that hurts trade. That hurts markets. That hurts customers. So that brings me to my last point, Jane. Number four, help is on the way. You mentioned the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. This is the Garamendi-Johnson plan. John Garamendi, Democrat from California, myself, Republican from South Dakota. And this does have momentum. This would hold foreign flagged ocean carriers accountable. This would tell them they are not allowed to unfairly discriminate against American agricultural goods. It would tell them that if they use American ports, they subject themselves to some basic rules of the road. They are common carriers. We need to have them act like it for the good of American agriculture.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Really starts with maximizing what we do with our strong root development and seed treatment.
Stephen Peterson, district manager for Syngenta in Wisconsin, on how healthy plants provide a positive ROI.
A strong seed treatment gives us an opportunity to be able to provide an even stand establishment, and which then therefore allows us to have an even herbicide application, allows us to be able to fight off diseases, and also keeps soil moisture in the soil, making sure that we have an opportunity for late season stress mitigation. And finally, it reduces nutrient loss, which allows us to be able to maximize our nutrient, our NPK and other micronutrients that we have and the costs that go into that. Ultimately, eliminating weed competition helps plants maximize their potential. And ultimately, as we look at this chart up here, what you're looking at is that we've got a corn plant, and this is just a scenario, but a corn plant that is competing against other weeds. And we know that early in the season, that corn plant is determining, is it having to compete, or is it able to grow naturally and therefore maximize its production? If it does have to compete, what ends up happening is that that corn plant or other plants will shoot up and grow taller to try to compete, and also the leaves will grow wider to out try to compete the competitive weeds that are in the field. So the early stages determine what will happen to that corn plant throughout the rest of the season. Finally, as a result of that, what happens is there's less root development, therefore a longer season, and less nutrients that can be put into what drives yield, which is ultimately the kernels. So all these things come together, and it takes away from the opportunity for a crop to be able to produce at its maximum potential. So utilizing a strong herbicide program allows us to be able to have greater consistency, enhanced control, and long, season-long lasting residual. Weeds compete for moisture, nutrients, and light, and using a strong, robust, effective, multiple site of action product allows us to be able to have lots of different ways that we can compete. So ultimately, we talked about where the roots are and what needs to happen there. Now moving into a weed side of the fence, we talked about how do we maximize that length of residual? How do we reduce the weed population? I want to have one key stat, or actually three. I'm going to tell you three. The 3-1-3 principle. 3-inch weeds take 1-inch water every 3 days. That's a lot of water, especially in the time that we have right now of the lack of it. Water hemp will produce over 100,000 seeds and will last over 7 to 10 years in the soil and still be viable. Palmer amaranth will produce over 500,000 seeds and be viable up to 6 years. Maybe longer. All these things are contributing factors in which we need to make sure we maximize the residual and think about the cost per day of control that we are bringing to the field. Now, moving from the weed side of the fence to a little bit higher in the crop with the fungicide or disease tolerance, I want to think and I want you to latch on to two key words, cleaner and greener. Now, what does that mean? Cleaner, free of disease. Gives us an opportunity to have cleaner leaves, therefore cleaner ears on our crop plant. Greener gives us an opportunity to see a healthier plant. So plant health benefits allow us to be able to expand the amount of nutrition that we are seeing in our plant and actually maximize.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The latest Ag Department food price forecast may have some good news for food shoppers. Economists say we may see very little in the way of price hikes for the rest of the year. Now, so far this year, average grocery store food prices have already gone up 4.8% from a year ago, and the forecast for all of 2023?
4.9% growth.
Agriculture Department economist Matt McLaughlin says if that forecast holds, of course, that would mean
continued slow to negative price increases. So we are not expecting prices to rebound in the latter half of the year, but rather continue that zero to incremental decline that we've seen for the last few months.
In two of the last 4 months, grocery store food prices have registered small monthly declines. Matt says it doesn't mean that prices for all foods will go down. He says shoppers, for example, could see more price hikes for beef in the coming months because of smaller supplies of cattle. Gary Crawford, Washington.